Welcome to the Collector's Show, where you'll learn insider secrets about collecting everything. Best places to buy, how to judge authenticity, and what are the collectibles of the next generation. Here's your host, Harold Nickel.
Greetings and welcome. Welcome to another edition of the Collector's Show here on Web Talk Radio with me, Harold Nickel. This week we're going to be talking about something we have never discussed, and that is collecting occult documents. We're going to be talking to Brandon Hodge, who you may remember from a few weeks back when he talked to us about collecting planchettes, and for the first time, Mark Demarest, and they have a lot to say to us that is relevant to people who are interested in collecting these types of documents, but I think collecting in general. It will be interesting, I promise. Hang around for that. Of course, just like every week, we're going to talk about the news from the world of collecting. You may remember that we spoke to John Tefteller a few weeks back. Well, there is a new book out about collecting 78 RPM records, and it's called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. The author is Amanda Petrosich, and it is, well, if she had listened to this show, she describes it as the untold story of a quirky and important subculture, the world of 78 RPM records, and the insular community that celebrates them. It's a really good read, and I guess I think last summer I had tried to get in touch with Amanda to get her to come on and talk about her record collecting, and she declined, but I'm not bitter. It's a good book, and if you like reading about collectibles and you enjoyed the interview with John Tefteller, you'll want to read Do Not Sell at Any Price. And of course, like with all our shows, you can go back and listen to that program. The beauty of podcasting, it never goes away. Another thing I discovered is that people collect airsick bags, and I'm talking about air sickness bags or barf bags, as they're also known on airlines. Not only do people collect them, there's a museum. It's the Air Sickness Bag Virtual Museum, curated by a man named Steven Silberberg. The website address is airsicknessbags.com, and, you know, I really want to get in touch with Mr. Silberberg and see if he'll come on and talk about collecting air sickness bags. Last item in the news segment is about a site called Vintage Wheels. It was started by a group of Etsy refugees. It's for car collectors, and what they do is they take data about different types of cars, they scour advertising, and they stuff it all into their computer with a series of algorithms that will analyze all this information and make it available. So you can go find a car that you want somewhere in the world. The problem with the auto market is that it's very fragmented, very splintered. So what these folks at Vintage Wheels have done is take all this data from newspapers, websites, magazines, and found a way to organize it so that finding the perfect collectible car is easier than ever before. That's all of the news, at least in this segment. We'll have one more real quick news segment in the middle. But first, Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest here on The Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel. This week on The Collector's Show, we once again have a chance to learn about something new, a new type of collectible, documents. But not just any kind of documents. These are occult and spiritual documents. Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest started and maintained the International Association for the Preservation of Spiritualist and Occult Periodicals, which is quite a mouthful. You may remember that Brandon was here a couple of weeks ago talking about planchettes, and Mark joins us for the first time. Welcome, both of you, to the Collector's Show.
Hey there, Earl. Thank you for having
us. Mark, did I say your last name correctly?
It's Demarest, but that's fine. No one pronounces it correctly.
Okay, well, nobody spells mine right, so I feel your pain. And since there's two of you, I'm going to just arbitrarily, Brandon, ask you this first question. What the heck is an occult document?
Well, occult documents have a rich history of reflecting, you know, the history of esotericism throughout the years. And in particular, I believe, Mark and I's interest are in documents, and Mark, feel free to clarify here, or in documents predominantly from the 18th century, extending a little further back into time, but predominantly from the 18th century, and then moving up forward through various phases of occultism and esotericism and spiritualism, up really through the copyright boundary. And I'll let Mark talk more about the formation of the IAPSOP, but really the occult documents are newspapers, periodicals, magazines, newsletters, and of course books, volumes, tomes, journals that cover occult topics or were produced or written by believers in different occult systems, beliefs, and spiritual and religious beliefs.
That's sounds like a very involved amount of scholarship, but I'm curious, and I'm going to ask Mark, the word occult. It seems like it's the sort of word that has a lot of baggage associated with it. Whether that's fair or not is something I'd like you to tell us about. And might you be better off choosing a different word, or would that be somewhat misleading?
It's a very good question. Popular cultural notion of the occult gets us really quickly into, you know, dark satanic rites and other things that sort of, you know, run smack up against the Judeo-Christian ethic and leave us with a pretty bad taste in our mouth. But as Brandon pointed out, there has been a perennial interest in belief systems of thought, most of which have very little to do with what we think of when we hear the word occult. And that perennial interest sort of rises in the mid-1700s and persists until sort of the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars in Anglo-American culture, and then it drops off quite a bit and then peaks again in the middle of the 1800s. And from the 1800s to the present day, you know, looking at all the data we have, there's a strong and persistent belief that there is some sort of hidden order to the universe, that understanding that hidden order has something to do with being able to heal yourself and other people. It has something to do with improving your ability to perceive the essence of things. In many cases, adherence to this belief system, whatever it might be, will grant you immortality. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, Brandon and I come at the problem from two different perspectives. You know, Brandon is fundamentally a collector of apparatus associated with particular occult movements, and I'm a researcher who's interested in the same occult movements Brandon is interested in.
But I guess it seems like if we talked about belief systems, I can swallow that a lot easier than I can things about a cult or even comparative religion, because it seems like, and I'm no scholar, but it seems like or sounds like a lot of these documents deal with different types of religious beliefs, or am I all wet?
No, I don't think you're all wet. Some of the belief systems that we collect materials on advertise themselves as religions, as alternatives to what they saw for most of the period we're talking about as the, you know, dominant Judeo-Christian ethic. But I think it's way too far a walk to call Freemasonry or phrenology, the study of the...
It's bumps on your head, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not bumps. It's the organs that make up your brain that exhibit themselves via, among other things, the shape of your skull. But, yeah, in popular parlance, the bumps on your head.
Okay.
These aren't religions. They don't speak about cosmology or the meaning of life, but they are nevertheless occult belief systems. They allege that the true order of things is hidden, but is discoverable, and typically they follow that up very quickly with, and I have discovered it, and if you pay me, I will tell you.
So, okay, well...
I mean, Brandon, do you think that's fair?
It is fair. I mean, but, and, you know, those are two examples of belief systems that don't butt up against Judeo-Christian belief, and in the sense of spiritualism, it can be argued that the belief in spiritualism, that is, that the living can communicate with the dead and vice versa, that's not necessarily incompatible with modern Christian doctrine either. It might not be acceptable behavior, but we find it very common that a spiritualist, you know, could go to church on Sunday, but attend the seance chamber on Wednesday. And so the interplay of all of these different belief systems, and certainly the systems, Freemasonry, phrenology, and others, that aspect of, you know, as one of my favorite subjects, THY, would be, you know, I would be more than happy to share these secrets with you in exchange for payment. And as collectibles come into this, the written word, we must keep in mind, was the primary mode of this communication, whether it be letters to the editor of a spiritual periodical or a newsletter that Freemasons received as members of their respective organizations. And in some cases, these were very small pockets, tiny communities of believers with often outlandish beliefs that weren't necessarily conducive to having large membership roles. And as a result, since we're on a collector show, the recognition that those documents were lucky if they survived at all, and in some cases there are very few specimens of them. So making sure that all of these are collected in one place really is the essence of the IFSOP's goal, to not only share them publicly, but to accumulate them all in one place so we can get a better grasp of what those beliefs were.
So it sounds like, Mark, that these different periodicals, this different writing, and as Brandon said, in some of these very small pockets, that these were the types of things that needed preserving. But I thought that libraries and museums were places that did that kind of work. What caused you to think that this material needed preserving?
Well, yeah, let me start by sort of describing how I found myself in the collection and preservation business here.
Okay.
My primary interest is the life and work of a particular spiritualist leader, a woman named Emma Harding Britton. Like all researchers, when I started to work on her, I read that which had been published on her,
mm-hmm.
and discovered, you know, very large numbers of factual inconsistencies, scholars who couldn't even agree on who this woman had married, when she had been born, what her maiden name was, but also the repetition of the same 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 things about her life. No one had read the 3 journals that she had edited in the course of her life. And in fact, no one in my immediate vicinity knew how to obtain them. The process of just obtaining those, you know, 5 years of one journal, 6 months of another, because that's as long as it ran, and a year of a third, it was very expensive. B, when I offered it to my coworkers in digital form, they were astounded that the material had even survived.
Hmm.
And there were almost no libraries who held the material. And perhaps more interesting, many libraries who claimed that they did hold the materials, you could go to their card catalog and see the listing for it, discovered when I inquired about getting copies of them that, in fact, those materials had been lost or destroyed years before.
Oh.
And I think the lost or destroyed problem, I think Brandon will agree with me because he has hunted
Absolutely.
Some of these up for me, with me, or instead of me, is quite common.
Hmm.
That although one might think libraries and museums are cultural repositories, they are under extraordinary economic pressure. It costs money to keep things on shelves. It costs money to keep things on microfilm. They dispose of, deaccession, those materials which are least often used. And so guess what's at the top of the list? The very things Brandon and I are interested in. I mean, Brandon, do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen it time and time again, and I'm going to ask Pat to share an interesting anecdote with a collaborator of ours, but we just see that over and over. I mean, just in a casual conversation with a nationally recognized public library, which will remain unnamed on this program, just in a very casual conversation with a collaborator of ours, the librarian just said, well, why are you even interested in this stuff? And are you interested in this stuff? That is, why are you even here looking at these items? Because no one has come in here and looked at these items in years. But secondly, are you interested in this stuff as in, do you want it?
Hmm.
So a librarian that we think from our public consciousness, as Mark said, we see these places as repositories of information. Anything that goes in there never leaves. They're vaults. But that is not the case. As Mark said, this stuff, it costs money. And I mean, for a librarian at a very large public library in a prominent American city to offer to just a casual researcher to empty shelves and shelves and shelves worth of possibly irreplaceable information that may be going into the collecting realm. It might, if we're lucky, get digitized and shared, which is our goal. But it creates not only an opportunity, but a frustration for us as collectors, because we're not just after the physical item, unlike a lot of collectors that we hear on the Collector Show. And although I am certainly after physical items, for us, it's as much about acquiring that data. We're not only item and rare book collectors, but we're collecting that data. And in that case, we're actually taking something very rare, such as the single surviving copy of J.W. Cottrell's Revelation of Planchette, and we're making it more common by replicating it, digitizing it, and sharing it with the world. So that's almost sort of an anti-collector stance, where the collector wants to drive up value of that which they've owned, and we actually kind of take the opposite approach.
Yeah, it's interesting because a few weeks back we talked about recordings of very, very early Mississippi Delta blues recordings,
right.
And they were one in particular were Canned Heat had ripped off one, and Led Zeppelin a couple, but the man who had collected these had like the only surviving copy of the original recordings that had such a big impact on rock and roll. And it sounds like from the point of view of whether it's belief systems or comparative religion or occult documents, that you may have the one and only copy of, granted, an esoteric work, but still important to people who are interested in this kind of scholarship. And it is astounding to hear that a librarian would say, hey, you want this? And just allow you to walk out with stuff. That's
But it gets worse than that, Mark. Do you want to share that particular anecdote with us?
Yeah, I want to be clear. We love it when repository libraries offer to give or sell us their holdings. That's an appropriate and reasonable thing for any library under pressure to do. We have.
We'll get back to the conversation with Mark and Brandon here in a moment, but I wanted to let you know about another collectible that I think will blow your mind. Paper napkins. It's true that some people, like, you know, Mark and Brandon, they collect documents. Some people collect antiques or linens. But who would have thought that the disposable paper napkin would attract any attention from collectors? Well, they have, because people just can't resist the colors. They're not just white or pastel anymore. The designs, because there's every possible occasion with its own napkin and unique design. And, of course, advertising company logos. Anytime you eat out, unless it's one of these linen napkin places, you're going to get a logo. Most of the places I eat, the napkins have logos. So there is a collection online, the Napkin Collection Photo Gallery. It has a very, very nice display of all kinds of napkins. And their website is pbase.com/lettuce76/napkin collection. I think if you just Google napkin collecting, you'll be able to find this. And they've got Alf. They've got, which I hated, by the way, all kinds of business napkins, the Playboy Club, professional sports teams, every holiday that you can imagine, it's there. Napkin collecting. You only learn about stuff like this here on the Collector's Show. I thought you'd like it. Thanks for hanging in there with us. And now back to more of collecting occult documents with Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest here on the Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel.
There are documented instances in which members of the board of IAPSOP have discovered years' worth of extraordinarily rare spiritualist periodicals literally in dumpsters outside of major libraries. They are headed to the landfill.
My goodness. That's I mean, I can understand that, you know, space is at a premium and that the economy and hasn't been that great the last several years. But it seems like if it were me, I'd put an ad out there someplace and say, we have these things, and if people are interested, give us a call instead of just throwing it away.
Well, and from a purely collecting standpoint, anything that's rare has value. So how someone cannot first evaluate that rarity is really the mind-boggling thing, because, you know, just about everything's collected, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, without a doubt.
you know, and so, you know, out there somewhere, no matter what you have, if it's old and you're about to throw it in the trash, a good check on eBay might be the first way to go to see if that thing has any value. And in the case of some of these periodicals, there are some of these newspapers that we routinely see sell for, you know, in upwards of $50 each, which is a ridiculous sum for us as preservationists to try and acquire. So luckily, they don't always command those prices in our internal markets, but when you see that and you know the prices that some of these can command based on that rarity, and then to know that a public institution that's strapped for cash just tossed cash out the back door, literally, is rather astounding in its own right.
Yeah, the taxpayers were ill-served by whoever made that choice. So in addition to rescuing things out of the dumpster, or revealing, at least to me for the first time, that there's this black market of stuff available from librarian. Hey, buddy, you want a rare periodical? The chase is a lot of the fun of collecting for some people. Is that, Mark, is that part of the intrigue that gets you going out to find these rare documents?
Oh, there's no question that is, it's part of the discovery process for us. So in the not too distant past, Brandon discovered a very interesting collection of what we think of in our discipline as being ephemera, things that are not texts in the classic sense of that word, but business cards, carte de visite, spirit photographs, which are, you know, particular to the 19th and early 20th century, actual photographs of real live human beings and spirits, largely, if not entirely, fraudulent, nonetheless very popular. He discovered this collection. He spent the time to digitize the collection with the permission of the holding library. And just by virtue of the fact that that information was available, 2 months pass, and I am able to discover that what looked to be spirit drawings in the work of another spiritualist are in fact tracing paper copies of the spirit photographs that Brandon found in another location. So it's an integral part of our discovery process to chase things up, to discover that they are not where everyone believes they are. We are still hunting certain things that many libraries said they have and no library to date has actually been able to produce. There's the beauty of finding things in very strange places. Brandon and I have a particular interest in a very early Midwestern spiritualist.
We'll get back to the conversation with Mark and Brandon here in a moment, but I wanted to let you know about another collectible that I think will blow your mind: paper napkins. It's true that some people, like, you know, Mark and Brandon, they collect documents, some people collect antiques or linens, but who would have thought that the disposable paper napkin would attract any attention from collectors? Well, they have, because people just can't resist the colors. They're not just white or pastel anymore. The designs, because there's every possible occasion with its own napkin and unique design. And, of course, advertising company logos. Anytime you eat out, unless it's one of these linen napkin places, you're going to get a logo. Most of the places I eat, the napkins have logos. So there is a collection online, the Napkin Collection Photo Gallery. It has a very, very nice display of all kinds of napkins. And their website is pbase.com/lettuce76/napkin collection. I think if you just Google napkin collecting, you'll be able to find this. And they've got Alf. They've got, which I hated, by the way, all kinds of business napkins, the Playboy Club, professional sports teams, every holiday that you can imagine, it's there. Napkin collecting. You only learn about stuff like this here on the Collector's Show. I thought you'd like it. Thanks for hanging in there with us. And now back to more of collecting occult documents with Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest here on the Collector's Show with me, Harold Nickel.
Whose practices inform the entire movement in the United States, Western Europe, and Australia and New Zealand. There was one important contemporaneous pamphlet / book written about this particular medium. It was unobtainable. Pieces were circulating here and there, and then we discovered that, in fact, an obscure state historical society has the entire document and has made it available already digitally, but because of the way they manage their website, it would be impossible for anyone to find it.
Oh, dear. So they might as well, you know, put it in a cookie jar as opposed to the way that they managed it, which, I mean, that's a shame.
Well, and it's driven by, you know, it's not only driven by collector instinct, because there is certainly an aspect of acquisition. We must get this item in order to possess it. But more than that, it's driven, it's a strange juxtaposition of collecting and research.
Yep.
Because we're often looking for these different books, these different magazines, these different newspapers, because they contain vital information for our search, and in that sense, contain information that may or may not be vital to others. So that's where sharing it becomes important. You want those people looking out for you, too. So it creates a network that most collectors aren't really familiar with. Most collectors tend to be kind of cloistered. They don't, they either don't want others to know what they have, unless they're into showing it off, or they kind of jealously guard it. And in that sense, we can't operate like that. We need to share so that others know what to look out for, and you and one would hope are appreciative of what they have found through our website.
Yeah, it's
right. That's an excellent point, Brandon. That we, those of us who are actively involved in this collecting activity, know enough about each other's interests and enough about what's on each other's want list that we're not only collecting for ourselves, but in some cases, we are always on the lookout for each other, and it makes, I think, all of us more effective as researchers and collectors.
Yeah, it's an interesting community that you guys have, and when John Tefteller, the guy I was mentioning, who collected the super rare recordings, his I guess, network, for lack of a better word, is very similar. And that's another thing that brings collectors together, our common interests in different types of collectibles. So from that point of view, whether it's records, occult documents, they share those things in common with baseball cards or stamps. So getting back to this material, I looked on the archives of your website, and there are a lot, and I'm guessing hundreds of different periodicals listed, and I had no idea that there was ever this level of interest in this field. Does that remain, or are there just a handful of maybe religious scholars who are interested in this stuff?
Oh, if I had to take a guess, I would say there are at any given time a few thousand serious researchers and collectors working in this space. So that the core community is not any bigger than that, but we serve a very large community beyond that. Just a couple of examples. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands, millions of believers in these belief systems alive, working on this planet today. Their own history as adherents to a particular belief system is not available to them. The institutions to which they belong are in many cases unable to provide their own history. So just as an example, again, without naming names, sitting under the desk in my office right now are about 4,500 pamphlets from a particular occult religious tradition, very active in the first four decades of the 20th century in the U.S. I'm going to be digitizing all of these and putting them online, and then I'm going to be giving the originals to the church.
Wow.
Because they don't have this material. It's their faith, you know, and they have many believers. So we service the communities of believers. You know, Brandon and I are not theosophists or members of the Church of Light. I don't think Brandon's a Freemason. I'm not.
As far as you know.
As far as I know, that's right. Because, you know, secrecy does factor into all this. Neither of us are practicing phrenologists, but we service all those communities. And then there's another important community out there, and that is the community that we tend to think of when we talk about genealogy. There are millions of people out there looking to find their own history, their own personal history. You know, I probably answer 20 or 30 questions a week from users of the site who send email in, and more than half of them are questions from people who were looking for a human being, who didn't know that their great-great-uncle was one of the most important practicing astrologers of the 1880s and 1890s.
Wow.
And they find that person and recover their personal history in our materials. And you know, I think that's wonderful. You know, good for them and happy to be of service.
Yeah, it's so, you know, there are so many things in common that when I started doing the homework to put this program together, there are so many elements in common that something we've never talked about, occult documents and preserving spiritual periodicals, has in common with every other collectible that we've ever talked about on this program. It's about discovering people who have things in common with you. It's about discovering relationships, and it's about preserving things that have real historic value. And in the time we have left, and I don't know which of you can take this, but what's the historical value of these documents? And were you not doing this work, would these just simply be lost?
Brandon, you want to take that, and then I'll follow you up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess that value's in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? It's weighed on the interest of the interested, as it were. I mean, for us, I think we take the approach, or at least I'll speak for myself, I take the approach that this information, particularly, and this kind of comes from my larger collecting field of planchettes and talking boards and Ouija and such, these are pieces not only of America and really worldwide religious history, it's our cultural history, it's our religious history, but it's also our pop culture history. Mm-hmm. When it comes to these devices, even for non-believers, seances, table tipping, spirit rapping, these things were popular parlor amusements, even if you weren't a full-blown believer in spiritualism. Freemasonry is often, you know, I mean, just look, it drives a good portion of the Discovery, or rather the History Channel's viewership, you know, with all these conspiracy theories.
That's
and
right.
All this. So it's so much larger than just, you know, maybe sort of the mundane view that, well, that's just some old religion and that's not what I believe, so therefore there must not be anything to it. It's incredibly important to our nation's history, especially when you start to consider how many of our founding fathers were Freemasons,
yep,
for instance. And how many people in this country, as Mark said earlier, just the number of contacts he gets from people whose relatives were once spiritualists or important mediums. It used to have an incredible following that doesn't largely get recognized today. So just sheer statistics, the chances are you've got a former spiritualist in your family. And they contributed to a national dialogue on our religion that we feel should be preserved. And that preservation comes in the form of these documents. And I think it's incredibly important on a number of cultural and social levels for us to remember that history and to record it properly.
Well, that's so well said. And in the minute we have left, how can the listeners find these documents and find you guys online?
Oh, it's very easy to find us online. All they have to do is go to the group's website, www.iapsop.com, and click on Contacts. We are always interested to hear from anyone who's looking, anyone who's collecting, anyone who has items for sale. You know, we spend a great deal of money on a yearly basis, you know, buying items and digitizing them. We are active buyers in the marketplace, and although, as Brandon points out, we really can't afford to spend $50 for every issue of an obscure periodical, you know, we do bulk deals. We do buy collections, and we help people who have collections they want to digitize but don't know how to do.
Well,
so we're easy to get a hold of.
Yeah, and I'll post a link to that on the show description on Web Talk Radio. And I just want to thank you both. You've really, you know, showed us once again how important all different types of collectibles are, not just for the personal entertainment value, but for the historical value. So Mark Demarest and Brandon Hodge, thanks for being on the Collector Show this week.
Thank you.
One more word right after this here on the Collector Show with me, Harold Nickel. Back in a flash. Well, thanks once again to Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest for being with us on the Collector's Show this week. The final word I wanted to leave you with about this week's program, and particularly the interview segment, is that there are so many things that collectors and collectibles have in common, and it's the quest to find something that is important, even if it's only for a few dozen people. That doesn't diminish its value as a collectible. And I don't mean value monetarily necessarily, but value emotionally, spiritually, as we heard about today. And all of the types of techniques that collectors use when it comes to curating, organizing, and preserving those collectibles is a thread that you can weave all the way through this or any collecting hobby. Come back next week for the Collector's Show, where we will have another interesting group of guests and stories all about the world of collecting. In the meantime, you can go to the Collector's Show website, keep up with all of the latest news from the world of collecting. Thanks again for being here. Come back to Web Talk Radio and the Collector's Show next week. I'm Harold Nickel. Well, thanks once again to Brandon Hodge and Mark Demarest for being with us on the Collector's Show this week. The final word I wanted to leave you with about this week's program, and particularly the interview segment, is that there are so many things that collectors and collectibles have in common, and it's the quest to find something that is important, even if it's only for a few dozen people. That doesn't diminish its value as a collectible. And I don't mean value monetarily necessarily, but value emotionally, spiritually, as we heard about today. And all of the types of techniques that collectors use when it comes to curating, organizing, and preserving those collectibles is a thread that you can weave all the way through this or any collecting hobby. Come back next week for the Collector's Show, where we will have another interesting group of guests and stories all about the world of collecting. In the meantime, you can go to the Collector's Show website, keep up with all of the latest news from the world of collecting. Thanks again for being here. Come back to Web Talk Radio and the Collector's Show next week. I'm Harold Nickel.